Hi, this is Paul. Continuing to have some trouble with the software that I normally use. So actually I'm using the Zoom client to make this video. Should be sort of an interesting experiment on the technical side. But I want to continue in some ways the video that I made in the last video that I did. Let's see. Now I'm going to be in a different corner here, but we'll see how this goes. So a cluster of ideas that I've been juggling lately. Why does matter matter? And we're going to talk about that in terms of the meaning crisis and the, I think, indispensable video that Verveke and Christopher have made on that. What's the relationship between mind and brain or brains? What are we really talking about when we're talking about these things? John Verveke, is mind emergent? Is it from below or does it emanate from above? One of the things that I've appreciated about this course is that he started with philosophy, and so in some ways, we've approached it from a rather historical point of view to get the ideas of what philosophers have thought over time about mind and minds. Now, let's see if I can get the. There we go. Now, my last video, it was entitled, "Are You Fully Noble Object or a Colonizing Agent or Both?" And I was working off C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, which is, as you know, has been a favorite of mine and something that I'll probably come back to as long as it's useful for me. Now, C.S. Lewis, in a sense, starts the whole, see, this is the downside of this. It's a little bit more work for me to zoom in and out. C.S. Lewis begins the book by talking about naturalism. And naturalism is, in some ways, a conflict between a perspective that all there is nature, and that obviously, when you say it that way, it defines nature in a particular way, or is there the natural and the supernatural? In that case, if you're a supernaturalist, let's say, the whole show involves both supernature and nature. Whereas if you're a naturalist, then all there is nature. Now, then suddenly you're in a quagmire with respect to what nature is. What nature has come to mean within naturalism, it seems, at least the naturalism that C.S. Lewis is addressing, is the idea that everything is, in a sense, the whole show. That everything is one continuous process from, let's say, the Big Bang on, or if you want to try to imagine what happens before the Big Bang, or if you'll grant whatever the Big Bang was, we can agree that it was, and whatever happened since there has been one long chain of cause and effect with one thing causing another. Now, what that leads to is this question: is nature really only one thing? Is that all that there is? Or are there two things within the world that we experience? And two groups of things. And these two groups of things would be group A, things that go on of their own accord. And if you're a naturalist, all there is group A, all the way down. Okay? Or is there group B? Agents that move group A things, but are themselves not exhaustively accounted for by movements in group A. In other words, there are these, in a sense, islands of non-group A-ness that that didn't sound right. There, yes. Sometimes I have the sense of humor of a junior high student, but there are these islands that are resistant to being exhausted by explanation, the kinds of explanation that are group A. I did a little bit of talking about complicated and complexity. Complexity, at least in business terms, is imagined to be something that has various group Bs operating within it. In other words, the automobile engine is complicated, but a business organization, the Apple Corporation, is complex because it has within it all sorts of these little group Bs, these little group Bs being human beings. Now, obviously, this gets into the question of the existence of God, because God would be the mother of all group B. God would be the source of all group B-ness. And I'm not going to get into that right now, but that's obviously where this thing goes. The question, of course, boils down to what is the relationship between group A and group B? Getting the idea of what I'm describing as group A and group B isn't really very difficult. But if group B, is group B really just things we relate to with the spirit of finesse, like let's say my car that I name and talk to, even though I know it's merely complicated and not complex? Just high is actually the whole show, everything being group A, just highly complicated things like my car engine, and there is no group B. That would be naturalism, according to C.S. Lewis's definition. If naturalism is true, then the whole show is all there is, just since the Big Bang, a long sequence of interactions, not guided by any mind, and within which no real mind operates, at least mind that is resistant to the kind of explanation that categorizes group A. Now, what this also entails is that the prophesied death of God, well, that's in a sense a prophecy. God is dead. There is no group B, and it's consummated in the abolition of man. It's prophesied in the death of God. And it's consummated in the abolition of man, because if, in a sense, the mother of all group A, which is God, the unmoved mover, at least in Aristotle's terms, if there is no God in that sense, then there, in a sense, humanity does not exist either. I don't know if I'm expressing that well. Now, I was in the Discord server this morning when John's video dropped, and of course, Drawn was messaging me each little thought. He was going through the video, and it's like, I don't want to watch this video now because I got this other video on my mind, but I couldn't resist, and I watched it, and I won't comment too much on it, but it ended with such a tantalizing cliffhanger, because he got into Rudolf Otto, the idea of the holy and the question of sacred and sacredness, and this very much gets down into my group A and group B. Elements of group B, if they exist, are holy. In a sense, they're set apart from group A. We treat each other, we do not respect fully colonizing other human beings, even though, as Francis Bacon showed, science is an effective approach to members of group B. That would be theology when it comes to God. It would be psychology when it comes to us. But there's a certain deference that we treat with elements of group B, both in terms of practice. Even if we imagine that, let's say, something like the weather, which according to this nomenclature of complicated and complex, we imagine, although we don't know, again, we imagine that the weather is complicated, but human beings are complex. And again, that even that distinction of category exemplifies this differentiation between group A and group B. Human life is sacred. We treat it differently. The numinous, which is the spirit of finesse, where the spirit of finesse is required. You can hear that in the Burning Bush episode where God says, take off your shoes, Moses, you're on holy ground. That's a way of ritually, symbolically communicating to Moses that, well, a whole bunch of things actually, clean and unclean and so on and so forth. So very much looking forward to John's next videos where we're going to get into this. And I video 33 of a series was a very big one. Now, we do in fact act as if things are sacred, and Jordan Peterson's act as if God is real and his acting as if continues to produce some good things. Now, of course, with Peterson, it comes down historically, mythologically from the image of God that we find in Genesis chapter 1. Now, I'm still waiting for the update of that software to release that video I did on Pinker, because Pinker doesn't know his Bible, because actually the sacredness of human beings is spoken of and imagined all throughout the Bible, even though sometimes the treatment of human beings within the Bible isn't up to snuff. In fact, the entire conception of slavery in the Roman period has everything to do with this, because basically slaves were made See, this is where stopping share is kind of annoying. Basically, slaves were made. You come to a city and you tell the occupants of the city, look, we've pushed over cities that are bigger and badder with better walls and stronger armies than you, so we're going to win this battle anyway. Let's just cut to the chase. We'll give you option A, which means we storm and we kill you all, at least the men, and we take the women and children as our slaves and our wives and our... Or option B, we make you all slaves, because functionally in the Roman Empire, what a slave was a dead man. And actually, if someone became a slave in certain situations, their marriage, their contracts, all of those things would be severed, because the slave was functionally equivalent to the dead. And so then to be emancipated was, in a sense, to be reborn and to become another human being. And of course, people often complain, well, there's slavery in the Bible. Yeah, but there's also the book of Philemon in the Bible, and there's the book of Galatians in the Bible. And this actually gets dealt with in a very nuanced thing. It would be as if a prophet would come today and say, you know, abolish the internal combustion engine or 40 days and the present world order will be overturned. You might say, well, yeah, but we're kind of dependent on fossil fuels, so that might, in fact, cause a whole lot more suffering than, and in some senses, that's sort of what happens with slavery as such in the Bible, but I don't want to get derailed into that conversation right now. So Jordan Peterson acts as, you know, we act as if things are sacred. And in fact, all of the celebrity atheists who love to talk about this, well, they all act as if things are sacred. In fact, the morality with which they use to judge the Bible is based on the idea that of humanism, that human beings are in some sense sacred. And the only way that sacredness can be violated is if there are other goods higher on the value hierarchy that demand the sacrifice, hence the language, hence the words, of human beings. Well, this kind of thing is a continual conversation in the Bible. You're not allowed to eat meat with blood in it. Why? Because life is in the blood. Symbolically, that's the world in which the people of the Bible lived. And so that's why you don't eat meat with blood in it, because life is in the blood. And some fundamentalist sects continue to practice that today. Now, when the center doesn't hold, however, with respect to the death of God, because the death of God and the abolition of man are deeply, deeply connected. And group B-ness has everything to do with the idea of person. In fact, in many ways, at the center of the idea of group B is, in fact, our functional use of the word person. And once this erodes, you begin to see things fray. Now, in materialism or naturalism, and there are distinctions between those, but let's go with materialism for a moment. Now, remember, John Verbeke is a physicalist, and I think as John and I continue to talk, we're going to continue to find out exactly what his metaphysic looks like, because he's working it out, I'm working it, we're all working this stuff out, but it'll be very interesting as he finishes up his course and what he does with the next course. But materialism basically says, naturalism says everything is in group A. Materialism says everything can one way or another be brought down into processes that can be explained, maybe not understood by all of us, and maybe not even potentially understood by us at all, but this is a presupposition about how the world is. If meaning is just something we project onto the world, then we, assuming, again, but this is what's amazing about the Freedom From Religion campaign that comes to Sacramento every year or so, when they say, well, you know, the world's just matter, but I can experience wonder. Well, do you choose to experience wonder? And this drops us into Sam Harris's whole quagmire of free will and that entire discussion. Because basically, we act as if human beings can project meaning onto the world. That's a very group B property. Now, I had a conversation with a young man just this week. He didn't want it recorded and he didn't want it shared, so I won't give any personal details about the person, but I've had numerous conversations with people like this. And he, in some ways, is on the horns of of the dilemma between sort of the Jordan Peterson approach over here, in which meaning is real and can be experienced. And in a sense, I've often said that meaning is the sacrament in Jordan Peterson's worldview. It's the place where heaven and earth touch. And so if you do what is meaningful and not what is expedient, because meaning is in a sense the little gyroscope down here below that can navigate you towards the guiding stars, even within the box of secularism, you cannot know or see those guiding stars. And he was contrasting, this caller was contrasting that with John Gray. And John Gray was much more, and I don't know, I haven't read any John Gray books, so if this isn't a faithful rendering of John Gray, please forgive me. Perhaps it's a faithful rendering of Sam Harris. But the idea is that there is no meaning in the world, and that meaning has to, in fact, be projected or discovered or created by us. And again, as we listen to how John Vervaeke is dealing with this, meaning is part of this relevance realization process. And I've really enjoyed how this entire argument has been progressing. Now, someone might say, well, Vander Clay, if you're a guy who believes solidly in God and Group B and all of this, and in more than just a pragmatic, functional sense down here below as we human beings operate, but even make metaphysical claims, John Vervaeke's making tougher arguments for you to debug. Well, okay, that's true. But let's not worry about that, because if we're going to have these conversations, let's deal with the best arguments we can find. And, you know, as I've listened to John bring out his argument, it's going to be very interesting, because I would imagine, and I would love to see some really sharp, physicalists that might think that John's dealing with us is fudgy. In other words, John's going to be dealing with people like myself and Jonathan Peugeot on one side, continuing to argue for Christianity, but John's probably going to have people to deal with on the other side, more in the camp of Sam Harris, who are going to possibly have issues with some of what John puts out there. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how this course finishes. And I really hope that it's not just some of us religious people who are, at least within my channel and its purview, getting into what John is doing, but also I hope some real hardcore atheists, some more Sam Harris types, really listen to this and delve into this. Because as I listen to John, some of the approaches that I hear from celebrity atheists like Matt Dillahunty, you know, he just cuts the legs out from under them in terms of his cognitive science. It just is, they just have no place to stand. And so I'd really love to hear critique from the other side as well, but I think hopefully done in a much more Vervaeke way, where people will be, you know, where people will be engaging in conversation in order that we produce more light than heat. Okay. So where was I? That's the downside of this new process. It doesn't really help me keep track of it as well as I can. So sort of what has happened in the modern world is that there's been a split, and this says there's all kinds of splits all over the place. But materialists basically say, well, you have to project meaning out onto the world. You have to go find meaning. And this one particular young man I was talking to basically says it's sort of the difference between doing what's, you know, following Jordan Peterson, doing what's meaningful, not what's expedient, or becoming sort of a hedonist and doing what's expedient and, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. I see others who are sort of practical Gnostics or a practical Gnosticism that says, well, we're to transcend matter and go off into the life of the mind, and certain episodes of Black Mirror tend to delve into this. Kurzweil's singularity is on the way, and so maybe my consciousness, maybe this narrative or whatever, you know, whatever this narrative is that seems rather timeless and not subject to decay, but at this point seems dependent upon my brain and the health of my body, because if I drink too much, my narrative gets wobbly and it takes a break every day when I go to sleep. And well, maybe this narrative can be downloaded off into some computer system, and I can continue to enjoy life from, well, within a virtual environment. This would be the Matrix. Or if somehow this narrative is no longer pleasing to me, I can kill myself in suicide. That's sort of a practical Gnosticism. Or there are others out there who are metaphysical Gnostics, and they say, well, the body doesn't matter. And this tends to be more New Agey types, that I'm a physical person having I'm a spiritual entity having a physical experience. In fact, certain religions, such as Mormonism in some ways, that imagine the pre-existence of the soul before the body, somehow dabble in this. I've had certain Mormon friends tell me, well, we choose our parents, that I was alive somehow before, you know, then I came into a body, and then I'll leave this body and go into another form. I think that's a departure from Christianity, even though Christianity has within its narrative the idea of God foreknowing us. I'm not going to get into that whole business right now. So this is sort of the splintering that we see happening of persons right now. And this is in alignment with the person of God and the person of ourselves. It's also hard to know what's slide is coming next. So the point I want to make here is that we act as if matter matters. And one of the, I think, most powerful points in the symptoms of the meaning crisis video was this section. And I wasn't going to play it because I was going to use the other software, but now I'm going to play it. We'll see. Let's see. I don't quite trust. Well, let's... I don't quite trust hopping from one to the next. Maybe it doesn't matter. Let's see. Let's play it.
That's so defining.
Yes, right? I totally agree with that. I think that's well said.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's keep going. What would we now put, right?
So now we're going to talk about the idea of virtual exodus. We've already kind of touched on this. So
we're putting that where? Where do you think?
Now again, this video is about the meaning crisis, and they're laying out the symptoms. And again, watch the whole video. The whole video is just tremendous, I thought.
Maybe just to the right of the median.
Right, about here.
Yeah. It's pretty close, though.
It's pretty close to addiction.
Pretty close to addiction.
The virtual exodus.
It's pretty because virtual exodus espouses itself as an addiction in many
right.
cases.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
So what we mean by virtual exodus is a retreat into the virtual world as a compensatory
response.
Instinct,
right.
A compensatory response.
So you can see this in books like the book. There's a book, in fact, entitled "The Virtual Exodus." There's
right.
a book entitled "Our Reality Is Broken," and it's trying to document how many people are moving. Are restructuring their lives and moving out of interacting with the real world and real people and moving into virtual worlds, either the game world or social media world, etc.
That's right.
And again, the assumption is that this is a problem. And that's an expression of a whole bunch of moral assumptions that we have that are actually rooted in some ideas about the way the world should be.
So one of the things, it's worth talking about video games
yeah.
for a moment. And I have to preface by saying that I, unlike most people I know, I actually didn't grow up playing.
I watched
so
both of my sons
of
a lot, yeah.
Minimal expertise. I have a good friend, Patrick, who would be aghast to find me talking with any expertise about video games, because I consider him to be the expert. But fundamentally, it's worth saying here, before we get into it, that we're not saying that these virtual outlets have no value. In fact, they can have quite a bit of value, intrinsic and instrumental value.
No, we're talking about the exodus, not just the virtuality.
That's right. So this is not to say that virtual exercises aren't worth the time, right? It's not to say that virtual exercises have no value. It's to say that the their use as a compensatory response to the meaning crisis is the issue. It's not the virtual exercise or activity. It's the complete shifting of attention.
Yeah.
And you can see here, obviously, what they're expressing is a bias for materiality, and rightfully so, and I agree with them. And again, this is another act as if argument, because we act as if, well, if our son or our daughter is spending all of their time in social media or in front of a computer game, we act as if this is a problem. Now, maybe this is a bias that is just going to go away because we're increasingly going to go into this virtual world. And one might argue that in some ways, we already live in virtual worlds. Because again, even the conception that I have that I am a human being, this is built on this autobiographical narrative that I have in my head, that unlike my body, which is subject to aging and decay, this autobiographical narrative in my head that I very much associate with as my life, that's virtual. It's not, you know, where is that located? And now we might argue, well, that's the way that your brain has been put together. But is it? Actually, a number of years before I started any of this, I was seriously considering writing a book about some of these things, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, because I have a lot more thoughts about it now than I did then. But the question, again, this question of what is me is a huge question, because, well, I might say, well, I am this narrative that I've been running along in my head ever since I was young. And I remember I was in college, I was visiting my grandmother who lived not too far from my campus. And she had, my grandfather had passed away at that point already, and she was in her late 80s. And she once said to me, she said, you know, it's going to be hard for you to believe, but inside of my head, I still feel like I'm 21. And I look in the mirror and I'm just aghast at, you know, I'm this old lady looking back at me. And so this self, this autobiographical center of consciousness and personhood, this is a rather virtual, immaterial thing. And now in the naturalistic worldview, it's dependent upon my brain. And there's some real powerful reasons why we think that, because if I drink, I get a little bit wobbly. If there are episodes in my body, I can fall into dementia. In fact, every night I lay down and all kinds of wild things happen that somehow are associated with me, but in dreams I'm kind of in and out of things. So that's interesting. But then when I was, you know, thinking about writing this book, I also thought about the fact that my children know a me that's slightly different than I do. And in some ways, I have all these biases that cloud my view of me. And so my children can actually correct, and my wife and my congregation and my friends, and I am in some ways sort of a different me on the Discord server and in the YouTube comments and in videos on YouTube. And in fact, if someone, and I'm going to use a personal, I'm going to use that as a person, if someone needed to reconstruct me, well, they couldn't just use what's in my brain, because they would have to use everything in my context as well. Because, and we have this when we read autobiographies or biographies have to spend a fair amount of time talking about the context, because the person describing their life all by themselves only gives you not only a biased picture, but a tiny little picture, because that person can't be understood apart from the context around them. And I actually was thinking about this years ago, writing about this when I was pondering the nature of the resurrection. And in fact, this is actually a point made by the Jurassic Park movies. You can't just resurrect me and place me, you know, sign off in the cloud someplace, because me, apart from my context, isn't really me. And so actually, if, let's imagine there is a God, and imagine God is going to resurrect me, which is part of the package of Christianity, well, there's a God is going to, We need someone who can, in fact, not only know me, that the me that I know from the inside out, but also me from the outside in, like my wife and my children and my friends, and me multidimensionally now in all these virtual spaces with all the adequate corrections. And in fact, me before I was born and existed through the stories of my parents that then got imprinted in my genetics and everything. In other words, it's an extremely rich world that's all put together. The digital exodus. See, I'm still trying to get the hang of this. Hang on. Stop the show. So this virtual exodus is interesting because, in a sense, we're really disturbed by one of our children playing video games. They're leaving, and we're like, no, you shouldn't leave. You should continue to participate in this material world. Now, during the question and answer, I was also in the Discord server while we're doing the question and answer, and some people sort of scoffed at Verbeke's ideas about that AI is really going to bring dramatic changes. I think it will. And I think it will for this fact that, in fact, I now, through my videotapes and through the community that my videotapes have created and now embodied sort of in a Discord server, and you know, nobody cares where that, there is some place, either one or multiple servers that are containing all of this material, but we don't care where that is via the internet. And so it's virtualized. And as John said, it's the exodus aspect of this that we find deeply troubling. And but again, this gets into very deep, interesting questions about, well, the existence of God, what is the nature of the universe, so on and so forth. So living in your mom's basement covered with Cheetos, spending your time on porn and video games, we all look at that and say, not a good way to use your life, not a good use of your agency. There are better things to do. And as Jordan Peterson makes mention a number of times in his classes, well, cocaine is quicker. You just, you know, boom, maximum pleasure, and then you die. Not a good way. Why not? Now, as I was talking about what is a person, and that if God were to reconstitute me as a person, he can't just use the me that I imagine myself to be, although that's a part of it. He'd have to use the me that my wife and my children know me to be, and that my parents, my father, who has now passed away, he knew me to be, member of our congregation just passed away, that he knew me to be, that he knew himself to be, that his wife knew him to be, that his children knew him to be, that I knew him to be. In other words, in some ways, this whole question scales like this really fascinating conversation that Verbeke has put together about relevance realization. And I'd heard Verbeke talk about that with Peterson in the conversation that was recorded and on YouTube a number of years ago between Verbeke and Peterson. But I'm really appreciative for this class as he's really brought it out. And when he got into the section of Darwin and fittedness and relevance realization, why you couldn't have a theory of relevance, that video just blew me away. And it reminded me of Louis Menand's The Metaphysical Club, which was one of the books on Peterson's recommendation list. Because when I read this about Darwin, I remember reading it. I mean, it just, again, just, wow. I had so often when I was thinking of Darwin, I was thinking about Darwin in a materialistic sense. But what John Verbeke shows in his series is that the reason there'd been plenty of people who had talked about evolution, the processes of evolution that make its way towards, you know, towards us today. Plenty of people had talked about that. Why was Darwin's move a game changer? Was it just a tipping point? I'm sure there's part of that, but Menand, if that's how you say his name, I think really nails it here. when he says, you know, Darwin's fundamental insight as a biologist was that among groups of sexually reproducing organisms, the variations are much more important than the similarities. And this gets into the conversation that Verveke has with essences. Well, what is the essence of horse? What is the essence of dog? And once you begin to look at this, you begin to say, well, that's a really difficult thing. And Verveke doesn't want to throw out the notion of essences, but we got to get a little bit humbled by it too. So the variations are much more important than the similarities. Natural selection, in quotes, is named for the mechanism, again, let me pay attention to the mental models that we're using, the mechanism of evolutionary development that he co-discovered with Alfred Russel Wallace is the process by which individual characteristics, okay, there's selection in there, there's relevance in there, individual characteristics that are more favorable to reproductive success are, in quotes, chosen. Okay, now there's a word from group B. There's a word from person. And as Verveke notes from Nietzsche's quip, you know, we're stuck with this grammar that is very old, and we can have none other, and it changes far more slowly than we as human beings change. So are favorable to reproductive success are chosen because they are passed on from one generation to the next over characteristics that are less favorable. Darwin regretted the use selection suggested an intention, and that is in fact what this whole battle is about. Does intention, not from those of us who certainly act as if we're elements of group B, but the father of all group B, which would be the classic idea of theism, which is a god, has intention and somehow that was designed into the process. Natural selection is a blind process. That's in a way of using a metaphor of without intention, because the conditions to which the organism must adapt in order to survive are never the same. As if, in a sense, God would be as limited in our intentionality as we are with our little brains. This selection constitutes Jordan Peterson's God number one in his debate to Sam Harris. And again, whether that's a hypothetical or a psychological construct that we somehow require in order to make civilization work, or whether there's an ontological being behind that, well, again, that's a huge debate. But Darwin regretted that the word selection suggested an intention. Natural selection is a blind process. Again, that's an assertion. It's an assertion that you may believe or disbelieve, but how you can prove that scientifically, I've got real doubts. Can we talk about evidence one way or another? Perhaps. In periods of drought, when seeds are hard to find, finches happen to have long, narrow beaks, good for foraging. Will be favored over finches with broad, powerful beaks. More of their offspring will survive and reproduce. In periods of abundance, when seeds are large and their shells are hard, the broad-beaked finches will hold the adaptive advantage. Finchness is a variable, not a constant. And with that sentence right there, we're right in the middle of the relevance realization and the fittedness. Because what are we talking about here? We can't help but focus and select within the conversation to say, well, what is a finch? Well, finchness is a variable, not a constant. So what is a constant? Well, relevance realization, that seems to be a pretty good candidate for a constant, and in fact, what we're trying to talk about. Darwin thought that variations do not arise because organisms need them, which is essentially what Lamarck had argued. Now, again, what scale are we talking about here? Individual? Species? Because right away we're going to get into the question of essences and groupings and relevance realization, even when we approach it from this point of view. He thought that variations occur by chance. Again, this is an assertion. Because when it comes to human beings, we are regularly confused as to whether something happened by intent or something happened by chance. We certainly have the two modes, but a great deal of drama goes on behind human beings because, well, they hit me and I think they meant to. And whether or not they meant to really matters for us. If you look in, again, if you go back to that excellent Rebel Wisdom, Daniel, long German Schnackenberger or something. See, this is why I should always have better notes. That intentionality, whether it happens, everything's group A, there is no intentionality. There is no intentionality anywhere in the system. Or group B-ness. That differentiation matters to us tremendously. In fact, I would argue that part of the question, part of the process, boy, I'm booting a lot of group A and group B, part of the process by which we don't want there to be a God, as Thomas Nagel says, part of that process is we don't want to imagine that this world of pain and suffering is by design. That's a big part of the conversation. And now part of what happens theologically is that's compensated for in many different ways, in many different religions, and in many different theologies. Part of the way that's classically compensated for in Christianity, and especially in Augustinian Christianity, is the fall, that God created a perfect world, and the pain and the suffering of this world are a result of human choice and rebellion. That gets very deep. But as you can see, this is all ways of dealing with the question of the motivation and the question of pain and suffering in this world. I suspect that part of the driving force behind the assertion that there is no God is that we feel more comfortable emotionally, relationally, asserting that all of this pain is meaningless. It's accidental. But see, now when you get into, again, Christian theology and the story of Jesus, this is, of course, the New Testament addition to the Old Testament, Jesus addresses the question of meaning and suffering directly in the narrative. And so, again, theologically, all these things are being worked through. In all seasons, it happens that finches are born with marginally longer and narrower beaks than others, just as children and the same parents are not all exactly the same height. In certain environmental conditions, a narrower beak may have positive or negative survival values. In other conditions, for example, when seeds are plentiful and finches are few, it may make no difference. The selection, again, we're not really talking about whether or not there are forces operating in a group A mode in the environment that are changing species and animals. In fact, we, in complex environments, we basically, through all kinds of things like statistics and trying to read each other's minds, say that, well, some of this happens in group B ways too. But the assertion is that there is no group B, that intentionality is illusory. At least that's the assertion of some like Sam Harris. And you can see how that assertion would be an extension of the assertion of what Darwin makes. And the assumption is that, well, if we can explain the whole material world by the way it is today via all of these chance, random, intention-free zones, well then, why not keep going with an intention-free zone? The selection of favorable characteristics is therefore neither designed nor progressive. There's another thing you lose, frankly, in this. Because again, if God is dead and the father of group B is no longer here, then all the children of group B are deluded about their B-ness. The selection of favorable characteristics is therefore neither designed nor progressive. No intelligence, divine or otherwise, determined in advance the relative value of individual variations, and there is no ideal type of finch or essence of finch. There it is, right there. towards which adaptive changes are leading. Sound and fury signifying nothing told by an idiot. Now, I was watching 30, I was listening to 31 this morning, and now we get into this question of mind and brains. And so I was listening to this video, and again, this isn't, I'm not attempting to nitpick, because all you have to do is ask my wife, who is perpetually annoyed by my carelessness of speech, that I should not cast stones. But listen carefully as we're trying to navigate these waters about mind and brains. Now, if there's no group B-ness, then, and if you're a naturalist, then mind is completely dependent on brain or brains, okay? And in one of the question answers, I didn't bother to go and try and drum it up. Probably the best question asked of Jordan Peterson at his biblical lectures was essentially, if all human beings were wiped out, would God still exist? Well, in a sense, that question brings up the question of the ontology of God for Jordan Peterson, because, and you can see how it's connected with the question that that caller asked me about, because if meaning is only an experience I have between my ears and only something I project onto the world, how something in group A projects, that gets a little bit sketchy, then what matters? In a sense, meaning crisis. Now, let me see if I can navigate this transition.
There's a deep dependency between your cognitive agency as an, right, as an intelligent problem solver, and an intelligent general problem solver, and the fact that your brain exists within a bioeconomy.
Okay. Your brain exists within a bioeconomy. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. The question that's going to linger in our minds as we listen to this is brain and mind synonymous?
The body is not Cartesian clay.
Or I shouldn't say synonymous, I should say, is mind dependent upon brain or brains?
That we drag around and shape according to the whims or desires of our, you know, totally self-enclosed, or Descartes, immaterial minds. The body is not a useless appendage. It is not just a vehicle. So here I'm criticizing certain Platonic models. The body is an autopoietic bioeconomy that makes your cognition possible.
See, I can agree with that. It makes our cognition possible. But the reason I pause is, again, the mind brain. Again, this is one of these presuppositional watersheds that it's really helpful to continue to pay attention to when we listen. And I would say that the mind that I now possess, now time comes into this too. Don't forget that. The mind that I now possess certainly seems to be a function of the development. And in fact, my ideas, my formation is all that the mind that I know myself to be, the Paul Vanderclay, the person that I am, is dependent on this biomechanical world that I was formed by, also within time, okay? Because Paul Vanderclay 2 years ago is not exactly the Paul Vanderclay that we have here.
Without an autopoietic bioeconomy, you do not have the machinery necessary for the ongoing evolution of relevance realization.
Okay, so the relevance, again, this has been fascinating. The relevance realization has just been a tremendously helpful framework for opening up lots of things about us.
The body is constitutive of your cognitive agency in a profound way. Why embedded? And this will also lead us into the rejection of both sort of an empiricist and a romantic interpretation. Right? Why embedded? The biological fittedness of a creature is not a property of the creature per se.
And again, we just read Menand's treatment of Darwinism, and this is following. And again, if you go back over his other videos, essence, fittedness.
Right. It is a real relation between the creature and its environment. Is a great white shark intrinsically adapted? No, it makes no sense to ask that question, because if I take this supposedly apex predator, really adapted, and put it in the the Sahara Desert, it dies within minutes, right? Its adaptivity is not a property, right, intrinsic to it per se. Its adaptivity is not something that it detects in the environment. Its adaptivity is a real relation, an affordance between it and the environment. In a similar way, while I would argue that relevance is not a property in the object, it is not a property of the subjectivity of my mind. It is neither a property of objectivity nor a property of subjectivity. It is precisely a property that is co-created by how the environment and the embodied brain are fitted together in a dynamic, evolving fashion.
Now this again, you can see the relationship between what I was thinking about years ago when I was thinking about the resurrection, that I am, we ask these questions. Well, if I were born in the 1800s, I wouldn't be me. I have this layer of skin that certainly is a boundary and a barrier between one aspect of me and the environment that I'm in, but via all these different connections, including the video right now, I'm coming to you. Well, what is the me that is making that journey? And now you would say, well, it's sort of virtual. It's the mind of Paul. It's not the whole mind of Paul. It's a representation of Paul. It's these aspects of Paul. But this fittedness, this relevance realization, which again, I've so enjoyed these last numbers of video. I've learned so much by them. But so it gets into the question of, okay, now I act as if I'm real, and you act as if I'm real. I act as if I'm part of group B. You act as if I'm part of group B, but I'm deeply tied into this environment in many, many different levels.
It is very much like the bottle being graspable. This is not a property of the bottle nor a property of my hand, but a real relation on how they can be fitted together, function together. So I would argue we should not see relevance as something that we subjectively project, as the romantic claims. We should not see relevance as something we merely detect from the objectivity of objects, as perhaps we might if we had an empiricist bent. I want to propose a term to you. I want to argue that relevance is, in this sense, transjective. It is a real relationship between the organism and its environment. We should not think of it as being projected. We should not think of it as being detected. This is why I've consistently used the term, we should think of relevance as being realized. Because the point about the term realization is it has two aspects to it. And I'm trying to triangulate from those two aspects. What do I mean by that?
Now I really like this move. Now, we've seen John making similar moves like this in lots of different, when we bump up against lots of different things. And I think it's right. Now, Now, these transjective relations are real. And what do I mean by that? We'll go back to my conversation with him in terms of how I understand real. It's that they govern. They do govern. They govern matter. They govern materiality. They shape the world. They have importance moving forward. They're transjective. We're not projecting them. We're not simply receiving them. It's a real relation. And that's the reality of relations. You know, and actually when I think, you know, it's probably 10 years ago and I was seriously thinking about this book. Essentially what I was thinking about was the reality of relations. That relations are real and they're constitutive of not just individuals, but within environments and within this vast being. And now we're going to get into Heidegger. That's going to come with his videos. That we are engaging in as agents. I'll let him talk some more.
There is an objective sense to realization.
Now that word objective is also problematic, and anybody who's listened to my videos knows. And the problem is that we have to use all sorts of problematic words, or we can't communicate. And objective is, in a sense, that which resists our will. Now, subjective also often resists the will too, but objective is in a sense that which resists our subjective power, or that to which the subjective ought to yield. I've introduced an ought. So again, there's loads of problems here, but working this out.
Which is to make real. And if that's not an objective thing, I don't know what counts.
And again, the real is that which governs. So the fact that we're using these two words together is really important.
Making real, that's objective. But of course, there is a subjective sense to realization, which is coming into awareness. And what I'm using both these words.
And in this sense, that's the subjective properly, behaving properly, bowing before the objective freely, okay?
I'm using both these senses of the same word. I'm not equivocating. I am trying to triangulate to the transjectivity of relevance realization. That is why I'm talking about something that is both embodied, necessarily so, and embedded, necessarily so. Notice how non, or perhaps better, anti-Cartesian this is. The connection between mind, if what we mean by mind is your capacity for consciousness and cognition.
See, now right here, are we connecting mind and body? This is what we're going for. This is what we're trying to do, because with Descartes, they get split apart. But now again, this is hard. I'll let it roll. I'm going to have to think a lot more about this. And again, these videos are me thinking out loud and trying, because this is in a sense that what's the relationship between mind and body? Because if there are consequences for some of these positions that run very deep, very quickly, and we don't act like those things are true for real reasons.
Right? And body is one of dependence, of constitutive need.
Now, is it? Let me play that back.
Consciousness and cognition, right? And body is one between mind. If what you mean by mind is your capacity for consciousness and cognition, right? And body is one of dependence, of constitutive need. Your mind needs your body.
Now again, that's true. The question is it always true? There's no question that our mind is dependent on our body. But so now we're, now I'm going to get fudgy about this word dependent, because obviously if all mind is dependent on, let's, because part of the problem is we've got some habits of language here. Let's use brain instead of body. And even though brain is not the best word, because of course we're, the brain is completely, you know, it's distributed throughout the body. In some ways, Peterson makes that point quite well. Is mind dependent on brain? I'm not ready to go there with him. In fact, I don't think I will, because I've seen too much that suggests it isn't. So, but yet all of this stuff is true. And this is, again, for me, is why I believe in resurrection and not sort of a Gnostic disembodiedness, because, and this gets into, you know, what the world is. And theologically, it gets very interesting in why the world and why matter matters.
We're also talking not only about it being embodied, embedded. It is inherently a transjective relation of relevance realization. The world and the organism are co-creating, co-determining, co-evolving the fittedness.
And then the question would be, you know, I began, let's see, now I'm trying to remember how far I wanted to play this video. I'll play a little bit more and then think about it.
All right, let's now return to it. The proposal, now, before we return, notice what this is telling us. This is telling us that a lot of the grammar by which we try to talk about ourselves and our relationship to reality, the subjective, objective, both of these are reifying, and they're inherence claims. They're the idea that relevance is a thing that has an essence that inheres in the subject, or relevance is a thing that has an essence that inheres in the object. Both of those, that standard grammar and the adversarial, right, partisan debates we often have, I'm arguing, need to be transcended.
I agree with that.
And I would then propose to you that that's going to have a fundamental impact on how we interpret spirituality, if again by spirituality we mean a sense and a functional sense of connectedness.
Well, and this is where mind and brain, my mind, my brain, but also mind, capital M, matters, because, absolutely no question about the fact that the person that identifies as Paul Vanderclay and the mind that has been formed by all of the experiences, all of the people I've known, the genetics, the diet, all of these things, that there's a deep, deep connection. What happens then? Well, so again, I just had a good friend and member of the church die this week. And as I often tell my wife teaches children aged, you know, grades 1 through 8 in a Waldorf school. And I pastor a church where a lot of the people are over 70 and 80, and some are into their 90s now. I've been at this church 22 years. Now, I'm going to bury my friends, Lord willing, if I outlast them, which the actuarial tables will say yes. I'm going to bury my friends. And on one hand, that's a sad thing, because I don't want to bury my friends. On the other hand, I want to bury my friends. I don't want some idiot pastor sending them off. They get this idiot pastor sending them off. But key to so much is, so many of these questions come down to, well, what do you believe? Do you believe that I, when I, that you're again, you get into this question of God. Let's imagine that something of me survives the grave, something of me that isn't simply dependent. So when I die, what of me survives the grave? Well, videos I've made, memory of me in people who remain. But pay attention, that me is this disembodied thing. So now we've got the relevance realization onto the question of what on earth is me? What on earth is Paul Vanderclay? And Christianity essentially says that I will be resurrected. And if you look at the resurrection of Jesus, which is the template for this story, the resurrection, there's continuity and discontinuity. Now, that Christianity's claim is far more specific than life after death. And I think there is a lot of not hard evidence, but plenty of anecdotal evidence that human beings survive. Now, again, this is one of these watershed points. But obviously, this comes to matter when it comes to this question of brain and mind. Let's get back to the slideshow. So, all this stuff is, it's so fascinating for me, but it's also difficult. So the brain is in a bioeconomy, and the mind is related to the brain. The mind is also in an economy, though, and it's an economy of minds, and those minds are in bioeconomy. Those brains are in bioeconomy, and so that you see, it's all one thing. And again, this isn't alien language to theology. In the story in Genesis, God makes a man out of the dust of the earth and he breathes into him. And so in that sense, in the group A, group B-ness, we are the stuff of A, but the breath of the father of B, okay? And consciousness is the field in which the brain and the mind come together for each of us as individuals. And again, I would say evidence, it's very interesting, that little anecdote of my grandmother and the experience that we all have, that while my body ages and certainly what I eat impacts my mind, but there's an I-ness that seems to, or there's a me-ness actually, that seems to somehow transcend the brain-mind connection. And can I prove it scientifically? No, but we can't prove so much of this scientifically, yet we have experiential and historical and action embedded active ways that we live it out and work it out. And part of the resistance to making mind 100% dependent on brain is the potential catastrophe that it would seem to bring on the brains. Okay? Consciousness is sort of a field in which the brain and the mind come together for each of us as individuals, but then minds come together and transcend individual minds. Last Sunday, I preached a sermon on Jesus casting out legion into the pigs. And I did a rough draft for it, and you can find the final draft on my church channel. Person is an integration of various minds and subpersonalities or motivations. You know, we get that from Peterson, talks about that. And a real person is integrated. And actually, the Bible deals with this all the time, because the way in which we are to conform to Christ, Christ is, when you listen to the Apostle Paul, a collective. And the scaling of human beings happens all the time. And Jonathan Peugeot, I think, has really languaged this in some very effective ways and really taught me a lot about it. We easily have collective persons. And just as we as persons lack integrity, even though we have one brain, lack integrity, and what we long to do is come together to be one person. Now, Legion and all of those symptoms goes into the pigs, and the pigs drown themselves. Now, pigs don't normally drown themselves. Pigs are highly intelligent animals, and those pigs had been on the hillside for a long, long time. And if you want to get into the, well, is it just a story? Is it a miracle? You can listen to the sermon, because I actually get into that a little bit. And also the mental health issues of this, and so on and so forth. But the collectiveness of person, you know, I, Paul Vanderclay, and in some ways always Legion, but my goal, and it's not a brain goal, it's a mind goal. And in fact, it's a mind goal that has shaped brains. And so these two things are interacting back and forth. And this is where you get into principalities and powers, that a nation can have a certain spirit. And we talk that way and we act that way. And so minds aren't just, okay, the identity and the mind of Paul Vanderclay. These things scale and they become collective. And they work collectively. And in some ways, part of what's happening via these videotapes and these conversations and the back and forth is that my mind and John Vervaeke's mind and Jonathan Peugeot's mind and Job's mind and Joey's mind and Julian's mind and Esther's mind and Mary's mind and Karen's mind and Sevilla's mind and the minds of Anselm men and Vixen Dixon and all of you in the comment section who are vying to be first on the videotape. All of our minds come together while our brains do not. And this mind then shapes the brains. And so there's also this layer going on in that sense. And in order to watch it, there's relevance realization going on in that level. So this thing scales. This thing continues to scale. And the scale is what's so interesting, because again, Finchness is variable. And Paul is, in a sense, one person amidst the Vanderclay family, or within the living stones, the body of Christ that is living stones, or the class of 1981 in Eastern Christian, or the class of 1986 at Calvin College, or the class of 1991 at Calvin Seminary, and these things scale. And so you look at Finchness, you look at individual Finches, and you look at Finchness, and you look at, and again, all of these systems are all together. I think about this. So I had a physical a couple of weeks ago, and so one physical, he felt my thyroid. Hey, your thyroid's a little large, so let's look at some things. So then he takes some blood tests. He says, "Well, you know, everything looks good, but just out of the abundance of care, so you all out there, don't be worrying about me. Well, why don't you try a gluten-free diet?" It's like, oh, really? Because he says, "Do you have any?" He lists all these symptoms of gluten intolerance. I had none of them. Well, go ahead and try it. So, you know, I don't do so well on it. But so then, you know, for the last few years watching the thyroid, then I talked to my mother and she's like, "Yeah, my thyroid's a little large." And I see an endocrinologist. I've been seeing an endocrinologist for years, and they've been watching my thyroid for 20 years, and it's a little large, but everything's okay. And it's, so it's like, well, think about the fact that, well, what's with this gluten thing? What's with this wheat thing? People have been eating wheat for a long time, and there's all these theories out there. And Mary will probably dive into this in the comment section. That, well, maybe it's Monsanto that's affecting the wheat, or maybe it's the chemicals. And we can go all the way back to the fixation of nitrogen. If you've never read the Alchemy of Air, phenomenal book. Really enjoyed that book. Read it a number of years ago. But here's the thing. Mind and brain, and I mean, all of this stuff is deeply tied together, and so many of the relationships are so real, okay, that when we're looking at Darwin and finches and seeds and nuts, boy, that's chump change compared to the kinds of relationships that are going on that connect to the doctor, and he says, "Well, why don't you give up gluten? Why don't you try not having dairy? Why don't you try," and it's like, what's going on in the minds of farmers and all over the place, and the minds of corporations like Monsanto, and the minds of the culture that came together, you know, it's all one thing together, and brains and minds. Yeah, that's a really vital distinction to think about, but not so easy to figure out how it goes. Citizens of Uncle Sam, same thing. Then I watched, now part of what's been so amazing in my channel has been the creation of all these sub channels now. So there's Randos United channel and Karen, who has the Meaning Code channel. Karen contacted me a number of months ago and sent me a bunch of stuff. I was like, wow, this woman's smart and she's an artist. And then I did a couple of conversations with Karen, and then Karen started having conversations with other people, some of the people from my channel and other of the people within her network. And you know, Karen, she's only got 80 subscribers. And I think, whoa, lots more people need to listen to Karen because the woman's brilliant and she's hosting really amazing conversations. And so she's had two conversations with Michael, who's had conversations with me. And I got to reduce this here.
That affords.
And then she has this conversation with Michael, and this conversation sort of blows me away. And the whole conversation was great, but this section I really, really caught my attention.
Well, so let me throw something in there. This is an idea I was tossing around today, and it's just a picture. But I was watching this lecture today on quantum field theory. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to wrap my head around this, and he
just on the off chance I want to ponder quantum field theory.
He did a very excellent job, Dr. Tom. He did a very excellent job of describing or going through step by step how physicists have come to quantum field theory, and he explained it in a way that I could grasp at least a little bit of what he was talking about. That rather than the universe being made up of particles, you know, I had been thinking quantum field theory meant the universe was made up of quarks and quanta and but he says in actuality there are just fields everywhere. Like electromagnetic field is moving around, and then it comes into contact with some other force field. I can't even remember. There's like four fields that are out there, yep, all interacting with each other. And when one of them starts waving, it bumps up against another field, and that gets that one moving. And then it bumps up to another field, and it gets that one moving. And that everything is made of these waves that in some places tangle up into tight little wads, and those are the particles. The particles are just tightly wound up wave that comes in at different places, and that all of us are made of these particles, but we all exist in these fields.
Interesting.
I'll send you the link. Because this is the current state of physics. That's what they're saying. There are just these interacting quantum fields all throughout the universe that are made up of these waves that are bumping up against each other and interacting. But he obviously didn't say anything about consciousness.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, okay, let me say, I'll just give them their idea and say, okay, that's true. They have this field theory, and that's true. That's how the universe is made up. It's all these fields that are interacting with each other. But we also know that there is consciousness, and there is pain, and there is sorrow, and there is love, and there are all these things that aren't explainable by particle field theory. What if there is a consciousness field that is also completely permeating the entire universe? And it is one of the ways that consciousness field could be influencing all these other fields, kind of ties together with what Jordan Peterson talks about when he says, whatever you place your focus on, your goal, that's what brings into your line of vision, the actions that you take kind of bring new things into your field of vision that give you the information that you need for your next step and your next step. And so in some sense, you're sort of creating your future step by step based on what's in your field of vision. So if I'm just this wave and I'm a bundle of little particles. But these things are coming into my field of vision and I'm acting on them based upon my consciousness. What consciousness is showing me is the next step.
Right.
In some way, these consciousness waves could be interacting with all the other waves and causing the future to happen.
Now what's interesting is some of you might listen to that and think, well, Karen's just this crazy new ager. You don't know Karen. Karen is a very conservative Christian woman in many ways. And so it's not given to new age type woo. All right. And again, this is just a postulation, but when I listen to John and JP just messaged me, and JP, I gotta talk to you. I know you're going to Paris or something like that, so we'll work it out. We'll figure it out. But you know, the idea of, I mean, even this whole notion of fields. Well, that's an interesting idea. It's an interesting way of talk about a magnetic field. Well, why do we use that word field? Why do we use that metaphor to describe, to try and get a mental picture of how these phenomena work? I think probably because fields transcend and organize in powerful ways, in some ways, as does mind. And so you want to talk about a mind field, but mind does. And as Lewis says in Miracles, you know, our mind colonizes hand every day. Now, developmentally, when I was an infant, it took a while for my mind to colonize my hand. And now again, in some ways, my hand is not perfectly colonized by my mind, because what you can show is that my hand will do things apart from my mind. And so this is enormously complicated, but the question of dependence of mind is one of those, again, one of those convergence points, a presuppositional worldview watershed item. Because if all brains are gone, if all brains are eliminated, if all human brains are gone, we'll give you the apes and the monkeys too. If all life on Earth is extinguished, and let's imagine this is the only place in the universe where there is life, at least for this thought experiment, does everything go away? Does all mind go away? Because that is the question. Because the question is whether there is mind independent of brain. And of course, that comes all the way down to us with the question of whether my brain, my mind, that my identity, this person that is Paul, is in fact dependent upon this brain. And we could have all kinds of arguments about near-death experiences or ghosts or all kinds of things about this, but it becomes, again, one of these presuppositional worldviews. And again, C.S. Lewis begins his book, Miracles, with the story of the only person he knew that ever saw a ghost. She didn't believe in the afterlife existence. And so it's one of these watershed things that so many things tend to converge upon. Now, yeah, maybe this is a little too rambly. I hope I gave you some interesting things to chew on, but eager for the next installment, because, you know, even though, you know, John mentioned, you know, spiritual is a word that's fudgy. We got to use fudgy words, because, you know, these are better to use fudgy things than no things at all. And to get at what we mean by spiritual, and to get at, well, how, you know, people, oh, we're all one. Well, what do you mean by that? Let's be of one mind. Look at how that phrase works. Why have we come up with that? How can we be of one mind? May the mind of Christ our Savior dwell in us from day to day. Christian hymn. I mean, all of this stuff is very, very interesting. And so this relevance realization that John is mapping out, and again, I have to listen to these lectures multiple times, because each time I listen to it, it soaks in deeper and I get a better sense of what he's saying. His mind, the elements of his mind come through and make connection with me. This is a powerful way of clustering issues. And spirituality is all about group B. It's the question, where do ideas come from? How, you know, do ideas have separate on, are ideas dependent on brains? And if there is, in fact, this middle realm, these relationships, that relevance realization, that's sort of a middle realm between, you know, it's not objective, it's not subjective, it's transjective, which again, I thought really helpful thing. Well, how does this help us understand? Consciousness is getting more or less fudgy in terms of what we mean by it. And so, and then again, when he ended this video with a conversation of the holy. So again, God number one, the whole earth is full of his glory. Glory is, in a sense, the reflection of powerful holiness. I'll say it that way. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, God number two. The whole earth is full of his glory. That's God number one, the system of all systems and the person of all persons. So Struan asked me, well, how does your group A and your group B relate to your God one and your God two? Well, none of these, all these ones and twos and A's and B's are highlighting relationships. And so they become fun mental experiments to try to see relations between things. But in some ways, group A is the whole world is full of his glory. All of these amazing, complicated things that we can explore in their complexity, or explore in their complexity, but then have to pause in amazement of their, okay, we have to explore in their complicatedness and then pause in amazement of the glorious complexity, all right? And this is what we're working in. So, you know, I might have gotten stuff wrong here in terms of John's stuff and this whole mind-matter thing I'm continuing to work on. Brain, mind, we're continuing to work on. But again, lots of good stuff here. So hopefully the recording went well using the Zoom client. Talk about cheap software. You get that for nothing. I don't know if the recording and the longevity functions are only in the paid version, which I have for all of my conversations, obviously. Again, check out the Discord server if you want to join in the conversations about this stuff, because the Discord server has been an amazing resource for people to connect with one another, to talk about these issues, sometimes chat via voice with these issues, do question and answer. It's this whole another functionality, this whole dimension apart from YouTube. But if you say, YouTube's good enough for me, it's good enough for you, no problem. Got it. We just went over 300 on the Discord server, and that's been great, great fun. So I think I'm going to put this out Labor Day in the United States.